when this happens, I get like mad. I want like 5 years of my life back. I'm like mad at God. It's like, I wasted so much time, God. Give me this time back. I'm so mad. Hey there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave, raspy voice Rupert, coming at you from the other side of your podcatcher. With me is Chris, crystal clear Coyer.
Hey! Just me and Dave this week.
Yep. Hey,
hi.
Chris.
Yep.
What's happening? We're coming out of the end of the summer.
Yeah.
This is the time of year where I want to quit web design. But... how's it going for you?
Fine.
That's good.
It's hot. You know, I got so much stuff going on. Why? Summer is hard, isn't it? My gosh. It used to
why
be
does it
so
get
chill.
Harder. I don't understand why. Like, it's like seasonal affective disorder.
Does he have to go places? I hate going places.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless it's camping and then it's fine.
Oh, yeah. Then it's good. I've recently realized it. Like, I've now connected the dots. If I travel, my wrists hurt when I come back, like my wow. RSI kicks up because I think it's like using the flat laptop keyboard.
Definitely. That used
and,
to get me too.
And my phone, man, is I'm just about to throw it in the garbage. So I don't know what my options are other than like a Bluetooth earpiece or something.
Yeah,
so I don't
just
know.
Go full kind of self-care and just travel with a big gnarly ergonomic keyboard and just be like, this is important, so I bring it, you know.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm headed in life, and you know, if I want to keep doing this. So it's just been a intense like week of RSI pain, but hey, I'm here and I'm sick, so speaking what a great pain. I'm living my best life, Chris.
You know what? I installed yesterday.
What's that?
God, it was a couple days ago now.
Commander Keen
Parallels. I know you don't. Parallels. You don't have to install Parallels because I install it so I can run Windows. It's been a long time since I've actually been I'm just gonna straight up run Windows, not emulate it or like use a third party service or whatever. Did you ever do that back when you were in Macland?
Well, yeah, I think when I switched from when I started coding websites in with like Coda and FTP and whatever. And then I was like, oh, Windows is like different. Like those browsers are different. Like when I first learned that,
yeah,
I was like, oh, okay, great. And then I'd like boot up Parallels and check things in Windows. Yeah. And that was always a nightmare. But
well, there's so many other options. Space. There's VMware Fusion or whatever. Isn't that one like, I don't know. One of them's like free, like VirtualBox.
Modern IE, I think, is the site. It like gives you like free VMs if you want.
Yeah,
to test
Microsoft just gives you free VMs, and that changed the game a little bit. Which makes it makes software like Parallels even more valuable because now I can just I can just buy Parallels and then know that I get all that IE stuff for free. Whereas in the Wave long ago, I remember buying Parallels and then buying Windows because I was like, I have to have this, so I'm just gonna buy it. And now that having that stuff be free is great. But, you know, it's the reason it's been so long is not because I didn't test it. It's because I use stuff like crossbrowsertesting.com, not a sponsor.
Okay.
But I would just because then you can just fire it up and it's a real version of it and you can still. But I got so used to, and it's like that service is amazing and I plan to still use it. But it's like it does stuff like every 3 minutes or whatever. It's like, oh, are you still using this session? If not, I'm going to spin it down or whatever. And it's a little slow because it's got to, you know, there's not much they can do about that. It's got to like emulate it somewhere in the cloud and send it to you.
It's like just the right amount of time. And Browser Stack is what I use. And it does the same thing. It's like just the right amount of time where you like go to like fix the code. And then you look at the browser window and it's like, dead. I timed out. Sorry, dude, I'm done.
Yeah.
Reconnect. And you're like, oh man, dang it. Okay. Cool.
I don't blame them. That's just what they have to do to make that service kind of viable. And anyway, so it's, but then I just kind of had forgotten how nice it is to have just a totally like local, fast, no limits version of the browser you're trying to test in. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's things like interacting with the file system. You know, somebody recently brought up, like, wouldn't it be cool to have screen readers on browser stack and cross-browser testing? Because, like, you know, I don't have a copy of JAWS, but wouldn't it be cool if I could go into my VM system and, like, you know, that's just kind of niche. But you know, there's different, like, I need that kind of now with, you know, VoiceOver for Mac or something like that. Like, I need to, like, go into a Mac and I need to kind of turn on VoiceOver and kind of work with that. And maybe that does work already, just with the VM, but it's kind of, yeah, that's, I wish that stuff, I wish having, like, access to the whole computer is way different. So I actually need to maybe, I have a Mac Mini I bought a long time ago, the Broadcastertron, for the Shop Talk Show. I need to set that baby up in a, maybe just kind of put it here on my desk and,
yeah. Cause there's, is there like revert, is there a, do you now need to occasionally test in like Safari or something? And
Safari. Yeah. I mean, all my coworkers are Mac. So like I got, you know, you ship a bug in Safari, you hear about it 10 times or you see it on the mobile Safari, but, and that's usually only Flexbox weirdness, but yeah, it's, but yeah, I think it all comes down like, yeah, occasionally you just, yeah, you need to like test on everything or like if there's a discrepancy between Chrome Windows and Chrome Mac, you know, sometimes there is. So it's tough to, you know, it's always weird when somebody's like, oh, this is weird on my machine. And I'm like, what on earth? Like, how could it be different? But sometimes text rendering, stuff like that. So, yeah.
If, yeah, anyway, if you just, if you need to do serious work on something that you don't have, sometimes it's worth it to just be like, you know what, I'm going to do the work that it takes to give me a good development environment in the browser that I need to use.
Yeah, I've been thinking about development environments. I'm on Windows, WSL. I'm still very happy on Windows. Like, that's not the thing. But WSL is kind of slow. And on my laptop, even, it's very, very slow. So I've sort of wondered, like, could I get like a dedicated Linux machine, like almost like a VM, but like not a virtual machine, an actual machine, an AM that I just basically like hook up to my, that I just take around and plug into different computers. Like, I don't know, maybe it's a Raspberry Pi, but that seems underpowered. But like, could I get like a good like Linux box that I just carry around and kind of have to work on, and then it's, you know, on my network or whatever, so it's very quick.
Are you talking about like a thin client kind of thing? Like you, like a super powerful computer that stays at home and then you...
Yeah, basically I just like, I like Telnet into it or something, or VPN, that's kind of a clever VNC thing. Into it. And I just kind of like, okay, now I have this Linux machine, like running Linux on its own thing, but that's something I can maybe like look at doing. But
once the network is fast enough, I think that's kind of the future of computers, isn't it? Like, forget me needing to carry around all this processing power. The internet is fast enough to deliver the results of that.
And deliver it. Right. So I don't know. I've just been like, maybe Shopomaniacs out there have like suggestions or kind of get what I'm wanting or want to tell me I'm dumb, but I can, I just like, I am now like appreciating very fast, very native Linux, which Mac has, you know, and I think Windows is working on it, but I'm just like, what, how could I get it like now? How could I get like just crisp Ubuntu without having to like run Ubuntu on my gaming rig? So maybe I'd need to run Ubuntu on my gaming rig. That's maybe the solution. But anyway, but I'm doing such weird stuff. Hey, we should get into the meat and
potatoes. Well, let's do at least a question here before we go off the rails again on something.
Here we go. Ready? We have an audio question, our favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show. It's from Brian Reich. Here we go.
Hey, Chris and Dave. This is Brian writing in from Central Pennsylvania. My question is, how do you guys go about creating something from nothing? Here's a little background on that question. I've been freelancing for quite a few years. In fact, I would say I'm asking this question about 15 years too late into my web dev career. But in the last 5 years, I went freelance full time 5 years ago. And I'm to the point where I have so much work that I am hiring people. And I'm kind of going the agency route in a little bit of a roundabout way, I guess. But I come from a tactical background. I consider myself a very good dev. I consider myself fine on the front end, not an expert designer, but not terrible either. But I feel like where my big gap is the marketing side, where I honestly don't know the best process to get from getting a potential customer to determining a design that actually meets their objectives, or even determining what the hell their objectives are. Now, most of the other web designers or developers or agencies in my area, I don't think they bother with this stuff, but I also feel like it's a disservice to the customer if you're not doing it. If you're just slapping up a website that has the, you know, five things people expect to see on a website these days, a slider, an about us page, yada, yada, yada. You haven't thought at all about what the customer is actually trying to achieve with their website, what goals they have in mind and how to track them. I don't want to be that. That's what I am right now. And I want to be able to get to that next level where I feel like not only am I creating an attractive and functional website, I'm creating something that is customized to the client's actual marketing needs. So how you do that? All right. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Wow.
Okay.
Isn't it always called discovery? Isn't that the early stages of this thing is to be like, you sure as heck shouldn't start building something until you know that what you're going to build solves the client's needs. But then it gets even trickier when it solves, like, not just the client's need, but the client's customer's needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, like we do discovery here at Paravel, my company, which may be similar, just a small company-ish, agency. We feel like that's, and it's maybe like old, I don't know. I mean, maybe people just want the like bootstrap website, the like Jumbotron, three columns of features, you know, the fancy footer, and they're done, you know, with the sign up form. And maybe that works. Maybe that's a starting point. But what we like to do is kind of like figure out, okay, who's here, or who's like, it's almost discovery about the company, like who at the company has strong opinions, who's a stakeholder, like what are ideas they've kicked around or even tried and failed? What are they happy with? What are they not happy with? You know, what sites do they like? Because sometimes it's just like, oh, do this site. Like, you know, like you get like 8 months into a project and they're like, oh, just make it like this site. Like, make it like the McDonald's website. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, okay. I guess I'll make it, you know. So, you know, I think there's like a lot of, you know, I think there's a lot of discovery you can do, you know, that turns into like asking questions and things like that. And then do you have the skills to translate that? You know, is there, you know, colors, imagery, stuff like that, that really fits the brand's need? You know, I think often we just there is such a thing as trends. Do you want to embrace the trend or do you want to buck the trend? I mean, right now, illustrations all over your website with like a nice sans serif font or whatever, or serif font is like the super trend right now. And you know, you can do that and you'll look like Slack and Dropbox and every other site. Or you can like, whatever, go hardcore. Maybe you have a death metal vibe or something like that. I don't know. Like you got to figure out how you're going to buck the trend, you know, or like, do you want to stay in the mainstream or do you want to try to be kind of an outsider and kind of stand out that way? So
I imagine that you get hired at all because you think that they know why they hired you. Like when the first time you ever talk to a client, like why did you call this phone number? Why did you fill out this lead generation form on my website? Like why?
How did you hear about us?
Yeah. And so that's a good start because, you know, what if it's like, you know, Little Sicily Lasagna Company or something? Hopefully their goal is to sell more lasagnas. Right. You know, so there's probably some like pretty basic business goal kind of thing going on there. And so,
and they probably heard word of mouth, you know, like, oh, you should go talk to Brian. He can make a lasagna website, you know, and like, so somebody trusted your skills or something.
Well, and then there's probably a 95% chance they already have a website. Don't you find that's the, most mm-hmm. work these days isn't just make a brand new thing. It's fix the thing I got. Okay. So then you can put stuff in place right away. If the goal is sell more lasagna, well, how much lasagna are you selling now? So that you have a metric to go from. And then is that the only goal or what? You know, it's almost like who cares what the trends are. If the goal is sell more lasagna, just find a way to do it, you know?
Yeah, if they have an existing site, you can almost just be like, okay, I'm just going to apply like just a thin veneer, a patch-up job, not redesign, but a realign. And I'm going to like improve your components with kind of the best practices, like more prominent sign-up buttons, you know, bigger tappable areas, responsive, things like that. So, you know, that stuff too. So, but in terms...
It's funny that you do all this work, it sounds like, Brian, and do your clients just not care? Or like, if it's funny that you do plenty of work and you do all this development work, and then you're just not sure if it met the client's needs at all. Does that happen? Is that a thing? Are customers just like, sure, it looks great. Here's your money without any kind of achievement metrics?
Yeah, you may need to work with somebody, to see like how, I don't know, to kind of be like, hey, can we follow some metrics on here? You know, in the past we've had great success. Like we did a home builder in a small town in Texas. And just by the nature of having a website, even and having a good one, and it got some SEO juice, I think from like CSS galleries or something like that. It just shot to the top and this guy was getting all search traffic just from being a local builder. And so like we could very easily like see like the incoming traffic from that project. You know, I'm actually in maybe the opposite problem as Brian. Like I now have big fancy clients that have big like data driven goals, you know, so I, you know, can't even move the needle. You can't change the header unless you could prove it's like a net neutral improvement or a positive, you know? So you kind of have, it can kind of go way far. Like you can't even change things until you prove it's better, you know?
Well, that's a difficult situation to work in, but probably it makes sense though.
Yeah. I think when like billions of dollars is on the line, it sort of makes, I don't want to be responsible for that.
Isn't that the first agency I worked at, there was almost some kind of implied situation where it's like, you can tell us what you want and we're going to listen to what you want, but there's just some obvious, we're going to basically give you what you need because there's kind of some implied obvious stuff that you're going to want. If you're hiring a website person to build your website, you want more people to come. You want them to be able to find what they want to find. You want to sell them the thing that you have for sale. Like sometimes objectives are just obvious. Most websites, most of them are obvious. Are your customers getting what they want out of your website? Like, I almost don't care what you tell me during discovery. That's what I'm going to do for you.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you kind of need to, I think that question, like, what do you want the website to do? You know, generate sales would be probably the top one. Like, then you say like, okay, I'm going to organize the site to like generate sales. So that way when they come to you and they say, can we have the dog on the homepage? And this has happened to me. You can kind of be like, well, maybe the about page is like a better place, you know? So you can like, if you have like objectives written down and kind of established, I've actually been on a project where we couldn't quite nail down the objectives. Like we were like, what are the objectives? And they're like, well, they kind of change on every, you know, they can change. And it was impossible actually to like build the site with like no one agreeing on the objective, you know? So
yeah, that's tricky because I can imagine at a complicated company, you'd be like, well, the objective this week is that people aren't using coupon codes as much as we want them to be. Those work good for us, but people aren't finding the coupon code thing. And then that's like the topic of the week. And then then the next week, like people don't care about coupon codes anymore or whatever. And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. It's firefighting driven development. So you fight whatever fire is very important that week. So anyway, I guess have we given Brian his marketing boot camp? I think just produce good work, And maybe you need to do some footwork on like interviewing past clients, like what went well, what went good, like do post-mortem-y audits of your work and maybe interview past clients and see like, is this meeting your needs? Is like, what could we have done better or whatever, having those kind of conversations just to make sure you're kind of getting the objectives completed, you know, if that's your issue. Hopefully that helps.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by An Event Apart, my favorite conference series there is out there. Believe it or not, they pioneered the single-track, multi-discipline conference event. First to do it, still the best. Looks like by my watch, there's 3 shows. Could go to all of them, but more likely just pick the city that works best for you. Coming up here in 2018, they got Chicago coming up the end of August. They got Orlando coming up October 8th through 10th and San Francisco in December 10th through 12th. They're so good. You can't go wrong. It's going to be great. If you want to save $100, by the way, for sure use AEACP when you check out. It's good for $100 off any of those events, which is great. Event Apart is where some of the most important developments in user-focused, standard-based web design and interaction got their start, like responsive web design and mobile-first thinking and web fonts and typography to intrinsic web design, Jen Simmons' thing that she'll be on the show soon talking about. It's just a great conference here. It's so comfortable there. You go into this great, really beautiful room and you sit at a table and you have your own power strip and there's water and there's great internet and the lineup of speakers is amazing and it's like the shared learning experience that you're not going to forget. It's just one of the most well-run, well-happening conferences there are. I love going to it. I love speaking at it when I can. And the lineup this year is just incredible. They're different at each show, so go look at the lineup. But any one of them you look at, you're going to be like, yes, I really want to see those people speak. And then you go, and then you do see them speak, and then it's even better than you thought it was going to be. So go have fun. See you there. Bye-bye. Gosh, I went to a there's a city near us in Bend called Sisters. They have a big, very big quilting show every year. Just real, you know, hundreds, thousands of quilts. People come from all over, look at the quilts, learn about quilts, talk about quilts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a quilt conference just outside, you'd say.
And you went?
Quilt? Well, my wife's mom quilts, and I'm willing to go to anything, you know, just because I think it's fascinating, you know, this is a very specific niche topic thing, you mm-hmm. know, so it's be like, you know, dentists have conferences, although I'm sure those are a little different, but, you know, teachers do, and real estate agents, and university educators, everybody has their own conference, and it's funny how different they could be. I'm sure that, you know, you sit at a talk for something like that and it, you know, wouldn't land with a web developer as much or it might, you know, people that can talk abstractly about anything. It could be the most fascinating talk you ever saw, but I was at the quilting thing. I'm like, I wonder what's similar with other types of communities like ours, you know, like these are quilting people that care exclusively about quilting. What's the same as web dev? You know, like there's got to be drama in the quilting world. Like, where is it? Let me find it, you know? Which was funny. And it turns out there was. And I got like a good Twitter thread going of some quilters being like, oh man, you don't even know, you know? There's like this machine called a long arm that like helps you quilt, but it's a machine. You know, it's like a John Henry kind of story of should we allow these long arm quilts into the show at all? Because it's like cheating quilt making kind of, I think this, you know, and I just found that kind of stuff interesting, you know, like people being, you know, old school, new school. Anyway, I should dig up the thread and post it. Cause it's kind of like, you can see so much similarities between the types of drama between anything. Like if you can find similarities between web dev drama and quilting drama, you can draw a connection to anything.
So you're saying if I switched industries, I would be right at home with all my hot drama.
Yeah.
I can have a new industry with all the same hot drama I have come to know and love. That's totally possible. I can have it all.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I can get upset about like like some new technology that's invading my that's invading my field. Mm-hmm. That sounds
like
great.
If you use Bootstrap, did you even make that website?
You used pre-cut quilting squares. No,
you're just in the quilting
from the loom is the only way I do it. I only from the loom. So you don't loom your own wool? No. What I mean, is it even a quilt? I don't know. Back in my day, I used to loom everything from scratch, you know? I used to have to shave the sheep myself. Oh, boy. This goes deep, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I feel this. I'm feeling this. I'm going to switch industries. All right. Next question is, speaking of, I can't even segue this. Here we go. It's about autocomplete. Here we go. It's from Josh Smith. Audio question, our favorite kind of question here on the show.
You can't stitch these together.
Gents, I use LastPass to populate forms for things like address and credit card information. It's actually one of my favorite features of these types of password managers. Lately, however, when I use these tools, they are more and more inaccurate, almost to the point of uselessness. I get full name in the first name field, last name in the address, etc. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on these tools, but to my question, are there things we can do as developers to help these tools detect the correct fields?
How to make autocomplete better.
Yeah, and it's kind of autocomplete, but autocomplete I almost think of as like the native browser version of it. I wonder how how it works, you know? What does it look for in the DOM? Like type attributes, ID attributes? Like when you save a password in your native browser manager, does it save a bunch of like secret metadata as to where to put that? Or does it just like, oh, this thing looks like type equals password. I guess I'll chuck it in there.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think there's like keywords, you know, like password and name or full name or even CC dash number and stuff like that. Jason Grigsby over at Cloud4, he's a very thorough individual, but he wrote a giant post on autofill. Like it's maybe 10,000 words. I don't know. but it's like, it's basically like how browsers do autofill and kind of like the kind of autocomplete attributes. There's now a new type of keyboard thing too. Input mode. Have you heard of that? And that kind of can help your forms too.
There's a I have lot heard of that. Teach me though. Do you, now. Can you, is there, what's the 2 minute version of auto? What is it? Autofill?
So there's an autocomplete, and basically there's some like pre-specified keywords that you can put into this autocomplete attribute. So, you know, text area, autocomplete, shipping space street hyphen.
And these are standardized, you know,
kind of like, yeah, like semi-standardized, I think. And so it's kind of like it's an HTML attribute. So this is going to help native browser, fills.
Yeah.
And I would actually, you know, I'm a fan of 1Password. I use that.
Mm-hmm. Is that for Windows too? They got that?
Yeah, it's on Windows. It's got, I can log into it with my face, Chris. It's the best.
Nice.
But the like autocomplete, I think those, you know, I'm looking, digging up like these things. And I think like 1Password tries to use like the HTML, like it tries to infer from the HTML what to fill out. Or it remembers what you filled out in the form, you know, but when it's like a credit card form, it just kind of guesses. And I've experienced that thing where it does it wrong. And it just like puts your name 100 times in the whole entire credit card field. And you're just like, now I have to like delete it all, you know, but I've experienced that. It's not painful. It's just not helpful. I guess it stops being the helpful tool you're used to. That's it.
So Josh was saying, like, is there a way to teach? Can you do something as a developer? And it's like, I don't think that there's like a LastPass or 1Password like attribute that you can put on an element that's like, hey, LastPass, make sure to put the freaking password here, dude. You know, like that's non-standard, but is for a third party thing to make sure it gets it right. I would, you know, because of the popularity of LastPass and 1Password, I would consider doing that if that existed. on my apps to like make sure that the fields get auto-completed perfectly. Because there is some nice satisfaction to that. If you go up to my 1Password menu and say auto-fill my address and it does it absolutely perfectly, you're like, ooh, nice, you know? I'd say it does that. I would say on any given form that I use it on, there's almost 100% chance it's not 100% perfect. I don't know how to word that the right way, but there's almost always something I need to correct in some way on the form. And whose failure is that? Is it the developer's failure for not making the form perfectly auto-fillable that way? Is it 1Password's fault for just not being smart enough to figure out what's happening here and auto-fill it? Or is it like the browser's fault for interfering? I'm not sure. I think it's just a hard position to be in, you know?
Yeah, I think it's like it's almost like password managers are a useful tool, but kind of a dumb tool. Like they're just going to try to do the best they can, you know, and sometimes it's not, you know, super helpful. That said, not to like browsers are getting better at this. I don't know if you've used like the web payments API and stuff like that. I'm using Edge, which has it, and it's actually kind of aggressive, even on like websites that if it just detects a credit card form, it'll say like, hey, I have a credit card in here. Do you want me to just fill that out? Like I've stored a credit card in my browser, or like, I guess more accurately with my Microsoft account. So it's kind of like, hey, I can fill out, this looks like a credential thing. I can fill this out. And it's mostly good. You know, I think it has the same kind of foibles as normal, you know, autocompletes, but I think these new autocomplete, things are very close to like, I think this is what we want. There are X number of like attributes and values. And I think it can, and there's like autocomplete on off, to turn it off if you want. So I get, but most of the examples say on off.
I would say, look at the standards. There's gotta be, use every standard available. First of all, just code a semantic and correct form where there's labels that are clearly labeled, that are attached to the inputs properly, and you're using names and types and stuff that just are named nicely and normally, and something that just wouldn't surprise a third-party add-on like LastPass or 1Password, and it'll probably do a pretty great job. So if you're asking what can you do as a developer, just don't do anything weird. Don't put a name of like just gibberish characters that your app understands, but how could any third-party thing possibly understand? You know, just do kind of normal things, and I think you'll probably be all right. And then as a user of, I know on 1Password, if I'm on a page and I know that it's going, you know, you do the thing where you log into a new site and it detects what you've done and it says, would you like to save this information or whatever? Fine to let it auto detect, but you can also like prepare it for what's about to happen. You can even just hit Command N, save new login, which is telling that manager, I'm about to fill out a form. I kind of want you to watch.
Yeah.
And then it kind of, okay. I think it does a better job of that. Or if you know that you want to like override the existing one, there's like a mode you can put it in that's just like, no, pay attention, you know, I'm about to do something here that I want you to watch. And it's my guess that there is a bunch of metadata attached to every login that you do that you don't really see in your password manager, but has remembered a bunch of stuff about the inputs and where they are in the DOM and what it's going to try to do when it has a chance to next time.
Yeah, no, I wish it does. There is like some data on this, this Cloud 4 post of Jason's like if you know, users complete forms up to 30% faster with autofill, like things like that. And, you know, I think even with the web payments API, it'd be people just zipping through your form, and that means more success for the user.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait. So, have you actually shipped a web payments API thing?
Man, I'm trying. I'm like, hey, web payments. And then everyone's like, well, how many people have it? And it's like every Chrome browser, every Edge browser, you know, every PC, every iOS device, every, you know, Android, every Chrome browser has access to this, even Firefox. But like, I think it's in every browser, but there's not clear numbers on how many people use this feature and stuff like that. So it's kind of has this like,
I can't wait to use it as a user
source issue. Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's like great. Like, wouldn't it be great if you're like guest checkout on Target and it's like, Dave, you want to fill this out with all your Dave stuff? Yeah, hit it. Cool. It's going to this address. I'm using this credit card and anything else. And it's like, no, pay. And it's like, cool. Great. Sending it off to the payment gateway. Payment gateway comes back. Hey, he actually has money. Cool. Great. It's shipping to your house. Like, that's it. That's done.
At Target, but now you go over to whatever, Walmart.com, and it's the same exact,
Walmart?
Same exact flow. It looks identically the same. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, no, and yeah, just simplifying from the checkout button on the cart to the great, it's being delivered to your house flow. There's a great talk from, who is it? Hold on. It's on my blog. Hold on. Dave Rupert, live Googling, Edge Web Summit. I went to the Edge Web Summit in 2017, and there are a bunch of great talks. But there's a talk by, here it is, Molly Dalton, Pay the Web Forward, and talks about how like Shopify is rolling this out. So not only is like your e-commerce site like competing with Shopify, it is already, but like Shopify's in the process of rolling this out to everybody. But Molly makes the point really well illustrated. Like checking out has been the same like 14 or 15 inputs: your name, address, phone number, shipping address, billing address, you know, and credit card number, month, year. It's been the same 14 inputs since like the beginning of the web, 20 plus years since like Pizza Hut launched the first payment online. It's been the same exact thing for 20 years. And now like the browser can basically autocomplete that whole thing, skip the whole fill out 15 form fields thing and deliver it to your door, like be checked out
it's a progressive enhancement situation too. So maybe that's the pushback, is that people can be a little lazy about progressive enhancement because it doesn't mean, oh, I'll just change my checkout flow to use this API instead of what I was doing before. Not true. You do have to do it both ways. You have to put the 14 fields there. There has to be a way to check out the same old school way that there was before. It's just now you have to write more code. Now you have to decide if web payments API is supported, then do it this other way too. So now you have two checkout flows to deal with. Now, I get it. That's a little extra technical debt. It's a little extra testing. It's a little extra QA. It's a little more thing to keep your eye on and keep your brain wrapped around. So I do have some sympathy for people in that way, is that yes, this is more work, but it's more work that when it's used, you're probably going to sell more stuff. I can't imagine a world in which easier UX for your customers makes you sell less stuff. That would just blow my mind. You know, it's probably not the case. And it's the way forward.
It's like, and it's like if you had an iPhone app and you're like, hey, I can put Apple Pay on this, and like people's like checkout goes so much faster. 100% of project managers would be like, yes, great, we're doing it. Like, that's going to look great on my Q4 review, and then I'll post that on LinkedIn and get a new job. But like on the web, people are like, well, I don't know how many browsers support it, how many people would actually use it. But it's like, you know, and there are some things like how many people have a credit card in a browser. We don't know, or an operating system. We don't quite know those numbers. You know, what are the gotchas? You know, I think
it's
almost
the wrong question. I mean, I guess as soon as there's some enough browser support, then it's worth doing. But the question that I see less asked is that testing stuff? Is that like, okay, now there's basically a fork in my code base and we need to take care of those two forks equally well.
Right. But, you know, it's if you like throw up you can have it basically, you can test it both ways. You'd basically just, it'll go with a browser that supports it. It'll throw up like the, hey, you want to fill out this form, and you say cancel. And then it'll just, then you go to the fallback experience, you know, where you manually enter everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it should like theoretically be great, but you know, I don't know. I guess we kind of diverge from the autocomplete, but I think I want to say this autofill and this web payments API stuff, these are kind of the future of autocomplete, and we really need to kind of embrace that and kind of do that. And hopefully our password managers will trail us, you know, follow along. So, and hopefully, you know, putting your credit cards and stuff in a password manager can be kind of weird. So maybe that's, maybe we should stop doing that. I don't know. So, all right. Next question. I'm going to drink some tea. Well, if you can read it, then we're in good shape.
Okay. I'd be glad to find where we were. Adam Bucksek works at a game dev studio and does lots of things besides web design and development. But Adam says, I'm looking for a proven node-based static site generator CMS-ish thing. Adam says, I tried to roll my own. I resulted in a system which only I understand, which is fine for now, but we need something headache-free and a tad more future-proof. So what's the market out there for node-based static site generator CMS-y-like things? It seems like there's a lot of them.
Two big ones, right? Well, yeah, there's a lot, I think, but two big ones would be Middleman, right?
And that's Ruby, kinda, isn't it?
Oh, it is? Okay. Metalsmith. Is that one?
That's totally one, yeah.
And then Gatsby, right? React. So that's got its own kind of deal, but that would be a node-based standard.
And there's 11D.
Oh, yeah, shoot. That would actually be my first pick. Shoot.
Yeah.
That's Zach Leatherman's kind of new,
and people
like
are
static site,
loving it.
Static CMS,
super well done.
What's cool about it is you can use any templating engine you want. So if you already have templates written in whatever Mustache or Handlebars or whatever, you can just drop it in and be like, "Oh, use this template instead."
So
that would be actually my choice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Back that up.
11D.
To use 11D.
Metalsmith is a generic one. So not Jekyll, because Jekyll's Ruby. Not Hugo, because Hugo's Go.
Go.
Hexo is one. ViewPress, I guess, would be in the Gatsby bucket.
I've heard good things about that. Yeah.
I don't know. That might be about it. Brunch? I don't know. Yeah.
Check out 11D. I know. I mean, it's like in active development.
Yeah. That's our top choice. Use 11D. That's 11ty.io.
Yeah. Zach Leatherman's doing, it's still like in 0.5, it looks like, but I think a lot of people are using it and really like it. So that would be a good choice.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by a conference coming up October 1st and 2nd in Toronto, Canada. I went to it last year. It was amazing. Web Unleashed, put on by the FITC people. So Web Unleashed is coming up again in Toronto, the very first 2 days of the lovely month of October. So it is, you know, the front-end developer conference. And just to make sure that I get this to you before I forget or you forget, 50% off the ticket price. So you have to use this code. The code is CodePen. I'm going to give you the CodePen code. If you go to Web Unleashed and buy tickets for it, use the coupon code CodePen for 50% off of it. It's 2 days of over 50 talks. All kinds of stuff. Accessibility, AI, UX, UI, animation design, all kinds of different like framework talks. And of course, there's CSS stuff and performance talks and SVG talks and JavaScript stuff and interaction design. And even web security is there. Ethan Marcotte's going to be there talking about beyond our devices, responsive design stuff. Harry Roberts is going to be there talking about performance and Rachel Andrew talking about layout and Wes Boss talking about React and... Oh my God. So many people. It's going to be awesome. Again, Web Unleashed Toronto, October 1st and 2nd. Use the code pen as your code when you check out for literally half off. Very generous of them. That's Web Unleashed.
All right. Sean McDonald writes in, in a recent episode about typography, you mentioned line length several times. I've been doing this for about 4 years and never used line length. I just let lines fly free and somehow manage the width of a p tag or whatever parent container. Am I making a big mistake, or do I need to be using
line length? It's just confusion, Sean. Sorry. If you're already managing the width of your parent elements and p tags, that's exactly what we're talking about. There is no line length property in CSS.
It'd just be like max width on the p tag,
right? Basically, it's just a consideration that you need to think about. So if you're already thinking about line length and you're managing that by managing the parent container width, you're doing it correctly already. So congratulations.
Mm-hmm. And just, you know, let your screen go really wide and then count the number of characters. And hopefully, what is it, like in between 45 and 65 or something? So that's kind of the sweet spot. Trent, my coworker, Trent Walton, Fluid Type, Googling here. He had a post on this in 2012, how he kind of manages it. And he'll like set little characters like asterisks in the, like at the 45th and 75th character, sorry. Just so you can kind of see if you're in the sweet spot. So I'll include a link in the show notes to that, if that's all right. But yeah, hopefully that helps you.
So that's there's no line length in CSS. You know what there is in CSS? Have you seen or used this scroll dash behavior property? Scroll behavior.
I am very interested in this one. It's not everywhere, right? But it's
Who cares? Because what it does is you'll scroll behavior smooth, and then instead of jumping to, you know, if you ever force the page to scroll in some way, and the most common way to do that is to have like a hash link that links to an ID somewhere else, that it just smooth scrolls there instead of instantly jumping there. So it seems to me one of those things that, like, shouldn't CSS resets just have this in it? I mean, I guess it's a little opinionated, but like, why, in what circumstances would you not want a nice smooth scroll?
Yeah, no, it's awesome. I found a weird bug in, you know, in I think it's like Firefox or it's in between Edge and Safari. Like, you get it working in Edge, it broke in Safari. You get it working in Safari, it breaks in Edge, kind of thing. But it's like when you do like the scroll behavior in your on the like on click event or whatever, you say like scroll to with behavior
right.
Smooth or whatever.
Well, this is what I'm talking about, is that why would you ever do that when you don't, because you're right, there's a JavaScript API in which you can pass a parameter that says behavior smooth, or you can do like dot scroll into view and give it an ID of something and then say behavior smooth. You don't have to, because if scroll behavior in your CSS is smooth, it just does that anyway.
It should just do that. Maybe I need to go look at my code pens,
because I was it came up to me because I wrote this whole elaborate thing that would look for you looking on clicking on hash links, and then it would grab the ID off the thing you were trying to scroll to, and then you scroll into view to smooth scroll to that location, because I was trying to do smooth scrolling but do it natively. And then I, you know, it was like 25 lines of code that was doing this because I wanted to use behavior smooth. And then I was like, why? Just do scroll behavior smooth in your CSS and it's done. You needed no JavaScript at all.
On like the body or HTML, which do you know?
I dropped it on HTML and it worked fine. Because then it also inherits, you know? So it's like, if you have some scrollable div, it'll do the same thing.
Man, is this really what life's going to be like in the year? Is this
scroll behavior smooth?
You kids don't know how good you have it.
It's great.
CSS property that fixes scroll, not like 30 jQuery plugins that all bring their own.
We used to have to jQuery.
Oh, frick. I just did it with, oh my gosh, dude.
Did I just save you some lines of code? Here,
no. Yeah. No, I was struggling with like a fallback. I mean, this guy on Twitter, we're working it out. We're trying to like detect Edge and stuff like that. But man, this is like trivial. Here, I'm going to paste
it. And what struck me about it is that the browser support for the JavaScript thing, like scroll into view with behavior smooth, is the same browser support as the CSS thing. So it's like you don't have to, it's exactly the same. Like, what browser supports one, they support the other.
Yeah, you see that link?
I'm gonna click it.
You can open it in Chrome. It like, yeah, falls back perfectly in Edge, works in Chrome, blah, blah, blah. This is great.
That's exactly what I was doing. Window.scroll to, and then you find the offset target of the thing. You actually, so you went a little old school here. You didn't use scroll into view, which is an easier API, but scroll to is older school. So you'd be.
Oh, okay. Scroll into view. All right. Sure, sure. Yeah. But yeah.
But behavior smooth. You don't need, if you have behavior smooth, CSS does it. Oh, so problem solved, bro. Nice.
Oh my gosh. It's scroll behavior smooth on HTML.
Should be in every reset.
2018. This is it. This is it. Holy man, we got grid and this in 2018. Y'all kids don't understand. Man, I want to like, when this happens, I get like mad. I want like 5 years of my life back. I'm like mad at God. It's like, I wasted so much time, God. Give me this time back. I'm so mad. Oh, man. Anyway, here we go. Next question. Mike Bliss writes in, should I care about retina screens when loading images? I'm trying to use source set attribute to serve smaller images to smaller screens. But that causes fairly large images to be downloaded on high DPI screens. Seems like a huge waste of bandwidth, particularly on mobile devices.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the whole point, Mike, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I say, yes, it is. Cause I have a situation where you started using a CDN kind of thing that like got in the way of image loading, and it just served 1x to everything kind of thing. And I just need to go in there and get it all figured out. But it was kind of taking my high-res images, which I was uploading on purpose because I was like, when I create content, I'm going to create the highest resolution possible thing. And I want computers to deal with all the source set and the, you know, make smaller versions and deal with that for me. But it was doing all that. But then it was like, well, I'm just going to serve 1x kind of everywhere. And it just made this, I hate to say it, maybe I'm just snobby, but I can't look at 1x on my retina display. It looks all crappy.
It interferes with your monocle.
It does a bit. It's like, this isn't right. Nowhere would do this. It looks low quality. It looks, you know, and so anybody who was in my position that had a retina display, they would just be looking at this content I've created and just be like, it doesn't have that kind of high quality feel. And yes, does it take extra bandwidth to get there? Yeah, a lot more. 4 times more, but maybe worth it, especially if it's CDN'd up and it's optimized and you're not hurting browsers that don't need it. I just generally consider it worth it. If you're on a retina display, serve the retina image. And I'm sick of saying the word retina in a little bit. It's, I feel like
that's an apple. You mean the large, the juicy,
high pixel density,
the obese. Yeah. The high pixel density, the big image. I'm with you. I don't take the time to do source set 1x, 2x. You know, in my opinion here is generally like there's not a lot of 1x phones. I mean, you know, if you're in markets where it will matter, you know, India, Indonesia, you know, where kind of Africa where bandwidth is certainly like a huge consideration. Like definitely like consider that. I think that's could be a huge saver, you know, but you know, I think like you just have, there's, I don't know. For me, I've always erred on the size of maybe I don't give the full size image. I give like just a little bit more, like just a, you know, if my div is 1,000 pixels wide at its max width, I maybe give
1200, 1300. Yeah, I do that.
Just to give it like the 1.5x strategy on image. I found that retina screens tend to deal with that really well. I find that, you know, phones actually want that kind of higher res screen because, you know, my iPhone or whatever, it's like 3x or something, right? Like it wants the biggest image it can find, even though that's terrible for mobile, but you know, there's also other people who really want to like use source set and sizes and do a bunch of stuff like that. I think it's responsible and you can save a lot of bandwidth, you know, if you're trying to cut down your like kilobytes, but it's a lot of work. And or maybe there's a machine. Doesn't like Jetpack do this for you? So there might be machines that do this for you too.
We had Shane O'Sullivan write in about that. We didn't get to it when it was the hottest of all hot drama, but there was that kind of an NPM worm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Did you not read that? It was like it was some kind of ESLint thing got in there, and if you pulled it at this particular moment, then it would like. Gosh, I should have read up on this. I'm terrible. I don't actually know how it worked, but it was really super bad news for like a day.
Oh wow! So like somebody got a malicious package inside ESLint,
yeah.
Which is basically
everybody. I mean, a lot.
Oh, they like sucked down something. Yeah, I mean, let's say half of all JavaScript developers use ESLint. So if you NPM installed that day, or you most likely got this. Wow.
Did it get into other packages too? Was that the idea? I think it
may have. Oh, I'm sure. Like, well, it would have like a lot of things include, you know, ESLint, you know?
Right. Even if it didn't do that, it would.
Unless you had a satisfying version on your machine and it was like, yeah, I don't need to download it. Wow. That's a big
exploit. Shane is kind of wondering, is this like when this stuff happens, does it just, I feel like now that we're a week or two later, nobody cares anymore. Or did it actually change people's mind and they're way more careful about just you know, yarn install, whatever, man. Boo-ba-doo-ba-doo.
You know, I don't know. I mean, it didn't cross my field of view, so I don't know if it had some really intense repercussions. But this does seem serious. This is kind of the big, like, issue with these micro bundles, right? Like these like microservice packages or whatever, is that we don't know what's going into the big NPM module or node modules folder. And it could be anything. I would actually wager this happens more than we'd like to admit. Like ESLint's a big target. Like that's a big vulnerability. It's because it's so popular, but you know, I'm sure there's like
wasn't there a great Medium article a while that they talked about it as if they really did it, but it turned out to be kind of satire or whatever. But the idea that they used in it was like make a good commit to a popular library that does something useful, but sneak in something malicious and
like a crypto miner.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Yeah. Can do it, you know, you slip it by, you know, it's hard to blame an open source maintainer, you know, they look at a commit and briefly look at it and be like, oh, this looks good, and just pull it, and if it's a dependency of something, you know, if you target just the right package, it could be like, it's not a very popular package, but it's a you know, dev dependency or peer dependency of who knows what else, you can get up the chain pretty quickly.
I wonder how many people have like stuck like a crypto miner in their company's Webpack config, because like, who's going to check it? Like, no one's going to like touch the Webpack config, because like, they don't want to break everyone's dev environments. But like, I wonder how many crypto miners are just running on like gulp tasks and stuff like that.
That'd be funny. You don't even do it client side. You just let it happen in the terminal for all the developers.
Yeah. Just raking in cash, little side hustle. So
Shane had a secondary drama about Webpack versus Parcel, which I totally did not come across my radar as far as this hot discussion.
This has come across my radar.
Has it? Because so Parcel's like a, I don't know, easy Webpack or something. It's certainly the most common criticism of Webpack I see is it's just so hard. You know, it's hard to the configuration so crazy. And, you know, Webpack would say, have you tried version 4? It's zero config 2, you know? And then it just, I think people were like, yeah, but it's not really, you know, the second you needed to do anything interesting.
Yeah. It's zero config. If you like, you don't have sophisticated needs or you have your project set up just the exact right way. I've seen this. I'm a fan of Parcel. I don't know if you've used it, Chris.
I have not, but
it's pretty cool. It's zero config. Mm-hmm. You just say, like, you basically give it an entry point or maybe multiple entries.
Yeah.
And it'll go through, it'll find out, okay, this is your HTML file, what JavaScripts are loading here. Okay, great. I'm going to bundle those together. Okay, next, what, you know, what other page can I go on? And like,
yeah, it crawls it kind through of your intuitively, stuff and finds the stuff.
Yeah, find stuff and kind of boils it down into to.
But what if you need packages? A view loader? What if it finds a .view file? Can it handle that or not?
I think it can. I think it tries to do everything. Yeah. And it, you know, under the hood, it might even be Webpack. I really don't know. I think it's different just from the like way people talk on Twitter because there's a little punchy, you know, competitiveness.
Well, that's going what on, Shane which, called out is that they that he thought maybe they were doing some slightly distasteful thing, like hopping into a Stack Overflow question about Webpack and saying, have you tried Parcel? You know,
no, just really, like, it's pretty cutthroat. Yeah. Ooh, yikes, guys. Yeah, I don't know. I kind of, when I get a smell of this kind of alpha male stuff, I'm like, peace out, dudes. I'll uninstall both of your things. So that's sort of my approach. But I, you know, there is like, I think it comes down to preference. I mean, there's definitely a lot of like Webpack works very hard and does a really good job at packing up and like it's a really good like bundler tree shaker, you know.
Isn't there like it's like you start with like the like Webpack has very, very abstract and then it's this very powerful thing that can do anything, right? It's smart, but it's dumb, you know. And then so Parcel yeah. comes along and it's like, I see what people are mostly doing with Webpack, so let me make a slightly more abstract version that needs no config and handles most use cases and even does it faster. Great. Right. And then maybe they'll become another one along that's even more abstract, that is even easier and even faster or something. But then there's a limit. Like maybe that third one never gets the kind of popularity because people are like, well, I actually need the power. I think we kind of saw that happening with task runners too, in which that there was like Grunt, which was required configuration. And then Gulp was like, well, let's just go down to the metal with JavaScript. And instead of configuration, you just write functions so it can do whatever. It was, and then there was things started to come along. It was like, well, why don't you use Brunch? Brunch is like these two, only it, you know, requires even less configuration because we know that you're going to try to run SAS. We know that you're going to need to concatenate your file. So it just does that stuff automatically. You don't need to configure that. It just does that. And then that just didn't, I don't know what the popularity of Brunch is, but I don't think it's as popular as Grunt or Gulp. You know,
don't think it won the task.
Runner. No, I mean, it's probably a lot of people love it and whatever. And I think the creators of it should be proud or whatever, but it just didn't take off. People don't talk about it in the same way right. as the other ones. It just depends. It needs to hit this like right level of abstraction that is perfect for folks.
Yeah. I think some of the people who worked on Babel have moved over to Parcel. So I think that's kind of why it's maybe has some cred. But you know, web, you know, it's, it, it, you know, I think these tools are really, you know, I think it's great to have competition in tools. I think, cause I, for me, like, you know, the configuration stuff always got me, you know, and it's like, okay, well, all right, I'm doing Webpack. I can configure it to spit out a file. Great. I did that, but I want it to do this thing. And it's like, oh, bro, you don't know about Webpack ES6 lint loader 5000. And it's like, well, no, I didn't know about Webpack ES6 loader 5000. Oh yeah. You just installed that one. And it's like, okay, cool. Let me go figure out where that goes in my flow, you know? And it, for me, that was like tedious and made me feel stupid. Like I did not have insider knowledge on what like extra packers I needed. And what I like about Parcel is it's kind of just like, here's the most common things we're doing it. Boom. Like Babel.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like code splitting, stuff like that. So.
Cool.
Hey. Yeah.
I think we did it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for writing in. Please send us more hot drama. We really appreciate that. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Sorry about my voice this week, but you know, maybe one of these days I won't be sick, but probably not because I have kids. Follow us on Twitter at ShopTalkShow for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to ShopTalkShow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
ShopTalkShow.com.